The views expressed on this podcast are those of the participants, not of Reuters News.
So it's a ridiculous situation where fragmentation has negative military effects, but it also has negative economic effects. If you produce in low quantities, then the cost per piece gets more expensive, right? So the big task ahead is to accelerate ammunition production, accelerate weapon production, and do it at scale and speed and at relatively low cost.
That was Guntram Wolf, senior fellow at the Brussels-based Bruegel think tank, talking about the challenges Europe faces to spend more efficiently to bulk up its defense industry. Welcome to The Exchange. I am Lisa Jucca, European business editor for Reuters Breaking Views, coming to you from Milan. In this podcast, Guntram Wolf, who until very recently was the director of the German Council for Foreign Relations, tells us how the question of how to ensure Europe could become less dependent on US military was at the center of discussions at the annual Munich Security Conference in February. Europe spends collectively around 360 billion euros on defense, three times what Russia spends. Yet money is lost because national defense systems are not interoperable. To accelerate support for Ukraine, in any case, Europe should consider borrowing jointly between 50 and 100 billion euros to buy weapons and ammunition from across the continent, he argues. Welcome, Guntram, to The Exchange. Thank you very much for joining us. It's a real pleasure to have you here.
Thank you, Lisa, for having me.
So, Guntram, I thought it would be a real good opportunity, you know, to have you on the podcast because obviously you're an expert on defense and budget issues, and you've also been recently attending the Munich Security Conference, the annual conference in Europe that you know, is probably the highest level gathering when it comes to security and defense topics. So maybe I just want to start this conversation to ask you to give us a little bit of feedback of what you heard there and what was really central, you know, at that gathering.
Well, thanks, Lisa, for the question. And indeed, the Munich Security Conference felt quite differently this year from last year. Last year, there was quite a bit of optimism as regards the situation in Ukraine. And many other topics were actually on the agenda. People talked about climate change, they talked about health, they talked about many issues. Now, the one overriding topic was the pretty dire situation in Ukraine and the fact that Ukraine really lacks weapons, it lacks ammunition, and the pipeline for providing those from the West seems pretty empty at the moment. And so it was quite a feeling of gloom with Russia making some progress in Avdiivka, in a small city in Ukraine. And on top of it, the killing of Alexei Navalny on the first day of the Munich Security Conference was interpreted by many as a signal by Vladimir Putin that he's, in a sense, in charge. And so I think, yes, it was a pretty depressing conference.
I mean, we also had the conference taking place just a few days after Donald Trump, who is obviously a president hopeful for the next US elections, also seemed to scold European nations, NATO nations, who have not spent enough on defense and even threatened to withdraw US support, you know, for those who don't reach the famous 2% of GDP threshold. So, again, can you maybe give me and our readers a summary of where we stand now and also, you know, whether his complaints are justified or not in the current circumstances?
Well, the security situation on the continent is pretty jeopardized. It's pretty fragile at the moment. As I mentioned, Russia is making advances. Russia is also voicing nuclear threats, and at the same time, the support that the United States is giving to Ukraine, even in the current administration, is already getting weaker than it used to be. And that is in part due to, of course, a Congress that is divided and does not fully see the need to prioritize Ukraine aid over other issues of concern, such as the border issue in Mexico. So already now the situation is quite difficult. And then we had on top of that, as you described, Donald Trump's threat, which sounded almost like a threat of I dare to say even a mafia boss, pay up or you don't get protection. That threat, of course, was a very very taken very seriously by European policymakers, and as a consequence, there was actually a debate about nuclear rearmament. It continues that debate in Europe. The Polish Foreign Minister Sikorski has said in an interview that as the U.S. Guarantee, especially the nuclear guarantee, gets weaker, of course allies will have to think about and look into the issue of nuclear armament. So the nuclear issue is back on the table, which is, you know, a stunning development. And I guess the third sort of big thing is we are all starting to seriously explore and think about how to advance European defense mechanisms so as to be able to really replace the United States should it not be present as strongly anymore on the continent as it is currently. And, you know, that involves both sort of ammunition and military and weapon production, as well as, of course, preparing for the lack of American leadership, meaning investing into intelligence, investing into strategic thinking, investing into, you know, also building European capacities that could function without the United States. I mean, this kind of thinking is starting, and I would say it's a welcome development, because even if the U.S. president stays Joe Biden, then we will still clearly have to shoulder a bigger burden of the defense here in Europe. And perhaps my last word on this, Germany is, as a country, also increasing its defense expenditure quite a bit. And actually this year will reach for the first time the 2% goal of NATO for a very long time, which in a sense is a good development, but it's still rather timid in its commitment to build up and deliver weapons and build up ammunition production.
Guntram, I mean, could you help us understand, you know, maybe describe a little bit, you know, the European defense landscape? So what is Europe able to do nowadays, and what it isn't and should do? And is it possible to put a figure or an estimate, you know, because you've obviously talked about investments, you know, the need to expand capability that costs money?
Well, I mean, here is the paradox. European countries spend annually, every year, they spend around $360 billion on defense. So it's a lot of money that is being spent on defense. And if you compare it with the war economy of Russia in 2024, so this year, Russia actually only spends $120 billion, right? Despite a massive increase compared to the last 2 years. So we spent a lot more on defense than Russia, yet it doesn't seem to be enough. And it doesn't seem to be enough because we are fragmented. We are fragmented militarily, meaning our systems do not operate together, our command structures are not really operating together. And on the military side, the thing that glues us together is NATO and essentially the United States with its strategic assets that it deploys on the continent. That's the military side. On the economic industrial side, we actually are also fragmented, meaning we have a multitude of weapon systems that do not work, correspond to each other, are not interoperable. So just to give you a very simple example, if you take an artillery shell, 155 millimeter, from a Dutch producer, and you put it into a German howitzer, then you will see that the precision will go down relative to a German shell being put in a German howitzer. So it's a ridiculous situation, even though it's the same, basically the same product, right? So it's a ridiculous situation where fragmentation has negative military effects, but it also has negative economic effects. If you produce in low quantities, then the cost per piece gets more expensive, right? So the big task ahead is to accelerate ammunition production, accelerate weapon production, and do it at scale and speed and at relatively low cost. And this is what the European Commission wants to achieve with its upcoming European Economic Defense Strategy.
So the defense strategy is due relatively soon, not officially unveiled yet, but do you get a sense of what the Commission may propose, and would these proposals make sense?
Well, the European Commission hasn't yet released the document, but what we hear is that it wants to propose a European industrial defense strategy. So meaning this is an industrial policy strategy. I hope that it includes the industrial policy side as well as the single market side. The single market side is very important so that buyers of military equipment buy throughout the entire single market and not just with their national suppliers. And the industrial policy side is important so that we will see more synergies, possibly even more consolidation of weapon systems into individual producers can scale up and increase the number and the quantity of pieces produced so as to bring down the cost. So it's really those two things, the integration of the market and the integration of the industry.
Some defense companies have recently called, I mean, I'm thinking about Leonardo. I mean, this is the defense company where I'm currently based, Italy. They've called for lower antitrust barriers, you know, to foster tie-ups and you know, as you say, reduce the fragmentation in the European market. I mean, what kind of barriers are there that prevent, you know, more mergers?
Well, of course, there's the antitrust question. So is the competition enforcement too strict for these companies to scale? But there's also the question of, national biases, which I think is probably an even more important question, right? I mean, we have a very, very long established relation between national militaries, the national defense ministries and procurement offices, and their national suppliers. I mean, this is the core of sort of sovereignty, sovereign private business nexus, which, and I made the analogy to banking union, which is in many senses comparable to the financial system. I mean, at the height of the Eurozone financial crisis, we realized that the strong embrace between governments and banks was the cause of the fragility of the Eurozone. And the Eurozone then decided to sort of reduce this embrace between governments and banks. And I think this is what we are talking about now, is something quite comparable, both in terms of sort of the intrusion into national sovereignty, as well as the necessity to fend off and fight off a pretty big security crisis.
Absolutely. But, you know, I also can see that, you know, when we're looking at the largest players in defense in Europe, well, many of them are based in the largest countries, right? So obviously Germany, France, I mean, the UK is not part of the EU, but, you know, with BAE Systems, you know, they're a large player Italy to a certain extent. I mean, Sweden, although it's a smaller country, but you know, it's not that, you know, each small country has necessarily a national champion or, you know, a company of a size that, you know, can somehow be of European scale. So I'm just wondering whether the smaller countries, in a way, I know it doesn't sound great to say that, but should somehow fold in, you know, with the largest one to avoid, you know, some of the inefficiencies, to reduce this fragmentation, you know, which you've also mentioned.
Well, I wish I had a very good answer to your question, but I don't yet have one. This is really evolving research, and I'm starting to work really on this this topic, looking much, much more in detail into the sector. It is true that we have in some small countries very important companies, right, that are important players, and that produce military products that are really particularly needed and suitable for their local circumstances, right? I mean, Swedish defense companies certainly know a lot more about how to prepare certain systems for harsh northern weather conditions than an Italian company, right? So there is certainly some advantages in local production, therefore, I wouldn't sort of frame this in terms of small countries versus large countries. I think probably my hunch will be probably it's more about making sure that systems become more interoperable and therefore exchangeable, and thereby increasing economies of scale, and while at the same time having some competition. But again, I think this is a very, very complex sector, a very, very complex question. All I can say is that the current system doesn't deliver what is needed. It clearly doesn't deliver what is needed. And that it's that we are spending too much on defense for too little output in terms of security. And that going forward, we will have to really ramp up production very quickly. We will have to spend more. But eventually, we hopefully can consolidate so that overall defense spending doesn't have to be permanently much higher.
Indeed. So maybe there's going to be an initial push, you know, which requires more financial firepower, let's say. But, you know, there's a couple of other questions that I wanted to discuss with you, Guntram. So the budgetary situation of European countries is not even. Some countries, like Germany, has a lot of fiscal space, and actually Germany has even created a 100 billion euro fund for defense. Other countries, like again, the country I'm based in, Italy, don't have the fiscal space. I mean, the defense minister was just, you know, on record saying that the defense budget of Italy, which is around 1.5% of GDP, is going to shrink as opposed to going to go up because, you know, there's no budget space. So I wonder whether there's some need of maybe a pan-European instruments to somehow address the fiscal imbalances that we, or the limited fiscal headroom that some countries have.
Well, I mean, I think the answer is to that question is probably yes, and I would frame it, however, less in terms of redistribution, right? I mean, if you frame it in terms of redistribution, you will always sort of pitch the Germans against the Italians, etc., etc. I mean, that's not, and the Germans will find it very difficult to sort of put up money so that Italian defense companies get more orders, right? I mean, this is I think this is going to be very difficult. My proposal would really be let's put up a European fund to finance the support of Ukraine, because the support of Ukraine is really a public good. It's really concerns us all. The security of Ukraine is European security for all of us. And if we put up a joint borrowing mechanism at the EU level that amounts to, say, 50 billion per year, 50 to 100 billion per year, which is roughly what Ukraine needs, Then, you know, we have a lot of firepower at the EU level to buy weapons and to buy ammunition from all of the suppliers across the continent. This will not be redistributional so much because it will be bought from across the continent, but it will be delivered to Ukraine and will really provide a European public good. I mean, that I think we should definitely do.
I mean, we do have the European Peace Facility, which is outside the EU budget and with national contributions. Should we maybe consider boosting that up, or are you thinking of something separate?
Well, the European Peace Facility is a good step. However, the main issue is it is based on current revenues, right? I mean, it's not based on borrowing. And what I think we will, and it's quite small, to be honest. So it's not even, it's 7 billion or something of that sort. So what we need is something bigger, and we need something based on borrowing. And why do we need it based on borrowing? Well, basically because the spending on Ukraine's defense is a temporary war expenditure. I mean, wars, if you look at wars, wars have always been funded with public borrowing, right? I mean, no government funds a war by ramping up taxes massively to fund the whole war. This is an exceptional spending that Europe has to undertake. And economic logic, even the tax smoothing argument from Robert Barrow from 1979, suggests that this kind of spending needs to be funded by borrowing. And my proposal would be to do it with joint and several borrowing, comparable perhaps to the Next Generation EU program.
No, obviously it's very interesting what you mentioned, and I've heard, you know, some countries, you know, Estonia, I think, you know, recently said let's have a 100 billion joint fund. I believe, you know, it's been difficult for the EU to use common resources or budget resources because the treaty says, you know, we shouldn't really use, you know, the EU budget to buy directly weapons. But do you think that obstacle could be overcome given the current situation and the concerns related to the war?
Well, that's a legal question. My interpretation, after having talked with a few lawyers in that space, is that actually it should be feasible to do it. It should be feasible to do it. But of course, the difficulty is more political. We will need to have a unanimous decision to go ahead with a joint borrowing program. And that unanimity might be difficult to achieve, especially with Hungary at the moment. And so if Hungary was to block it, I mean, then we would have to think about a second best solution. That second best solution could be a mechanism that is more intergovernmental. It could also be, of course, a program which is based on national borrowing. But then we come back to your initial question, how do we do it in a situation in which some countries actually find their budget borrowing room for maneuver and their funding costs much more restrictive than others? I mean, then it becomes more difficult. But you know, I think in principle it's worthwhile really going after the European borrowing thing, because if we have more European debt, it's also beneficial for the stability of the European Union and the Eurozone as a whole. So in that sense, I would be really in favor of really trying the European solution.
Well, Guntram, thank you so much, you know, for this conversation, which was really fascinating, lots of ideas, you know, a big idea that you put on the table. So it was a pleasure speaking to you. Thanks for joining us for the exchange. I hope to stay in touch in the future.
Thank you so much, Lisa.
Thanks for tuning in. This podcast was produced by Oliver Tashlich in London. Subscribe to The Exchange and our sister podcast, The Views Room, on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. Catch up with more of our views at breakingviews.com and on the X social media site, where our handle is @breakingviews.
I'm Kim Vanell. Join me every morning for a roundup of what's happening at home and around the world. From the front line in Ukraine.
Extraordinary how these people adjust and even laugh when you take cover.
To the heart of US politics.
When Trump said that he expected to be arrested, it seems like he was trying to get ahead of the story.
We bring you everything you need to know in 10 minutes. For your essential daily briefing, follow Reuters World News wherever you get your podcasts.